we can think about our money in a couple different ways. First, there are the numbers, the dollars and cents, the bank balances, the debt, the interest, the percentages.
But our next guest says it's about more than the numbers, that we all have emotions, feelings, and attitudes about money. And she says many of us at all income levels feel a lot of stress and anxiety about our financial situations. But the good news is there is a lot we can do to deal with all that stress.
Emily Guy Birkin is with us now. She's a finance writer, now based in Milwaukee. Her newest book is End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. She joins us from our Milwaukee studio. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how common, Emily, is money-related stress?
Incredibly common. It is one of the top sources of stress for most people. It causes marital problems. It causes stress in families. It even causes, when there are families that experience money stress, it causes their kids to be more likely to take on credit card debt when they grow up.
And this is all income levels, you write. No matter how much money we have, we might still be prone to being stressed about our money.
Absolutely. Yeah. Money stress knows no specific income level. You can be stressed if you have very little income, and that makes sense. You could be stressed if you have a lot of income, and that is something that people don't necessarily recognize.
And in your book, you write that not solving these money stress problems can actually make it harder for us to solve our money problems. The emotion can get in the way of dealing with our money.
Absolutely, yeah. Because we can't separate the way we feel about money from how we deal with money, what happens is if you don't have that separation between your emotions and your money decisions, you end up making counterproductive money decisions that can just further entrench the stress that you feel.
And in your book, you're not trying to solve all of our money problems. You're not helping us become financially secure, but you're helping us resolve some of the emotions and stress with our money. How important is it for us to do that?
I would say that it's probably the most important thing you can do with your money. Because there are always going to be money problems, and there is, sad to say, no such thing as financial security. I like to say even Warren Buffett would be wiped out by the zombie apocalypse. but there is always something that could wipe out any fortune, no matter how big. So the idea of financial security is kind of an illusion. What you can do is reduce your stress and find a way to think more rationally about your money and make the best decisions with the money you have. And that is the most important thing to do with your money, because that will allow you to always roll with whatever punches are coming, because there will always be money problems no matter where you end up.
And one of the first steps you talk about is figuring out our attitudes, our relationship with money. What kind of things should we start thinking about?
Well, people tend to think of money as being real simple dollars and cents. You know, if you can add and subtract, you understand money. That's the viewpoint that we have. But there's a lot of underlying psychological and emotional meanings we put to money, and even moral meanings we put to money. So people might think that money is a source of shame. And you very often will see that people will assign kind of moral judgments to people having great wealth or people living in poverty. People will think that money is freedom or money is love. And there is some truth to some of these. However, they are not the full truth, and without actually examining and digging into that psychological meaning and moral meaning and emotional meaning you put to money, you're not going to make the best decisions for yourself and your money, because you'll be letting those underlying meanings drive the ship rather than actually making the choices that are the most rational, most intelligent choices for you.
We're talking to Emily Guy Birkin. Her new book is End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. Emily, one of the big issues you talk about is the feeling that our finances are out of our control in one way or another. And that can be somebody at the lowest end of the economic spectrum. It could be somebody in the middle class who's wondering, why can't I figure out how to pay for, say, college for kids? It can even go up higher than that. Why do we feel out of control?
Well, one of the big reasons for it is something that psychologists have identified as the locus of control. You can either have an internal locus of control or an external locus of control. So people with an internal locus of control feel like they have control over what's happening in their lives. So just for example, someone with an internal locus of control who fails a test in college will recognize, hey, I didn't study hard enough. I should have done more. The external locus of control makes it feel like things happen to you, life happens to you. So someone who fails a test with an external locus of control will think, the questions were too hard, the teacher was out to get me, I just can't get a break. So when you have an internal locus of control, you're much more likely to be able to feel like, hey, this money is a puzzle I can solve, it's something I can figure out. Whereas if you have an external locus of control, you're much more likely to think, this is what happens to me, the man is keeping me down, or there's no way to get ahead, so I might as well not try.
But it sounds like there's a risk that maybe we could go too far and turn that into self-blame as opposed to just self-control when it comes to money.
Absolutely. There's always kind of a balance you need to strike. You know, the internal locus of control, the other problem with that is if you have, you know, too high self-esteem about that sort of thing, you might jump into risky investments because you think, oh, I can't control it, I can handle it, and that sort of thing. And so that could also lead you astray. So those are the sorts of things there in everything. You need to have a balance and try to figure out what is going to make the most sense rationally, which we all think we're rational, but no one really is. Everyone is irrational about money. And so recognizing when you're being irrational and recognizing when you could make a better decision is really important.
And Emily, suppose somebody listening is thinking, yeah, I do feel like my finances are out of my control. I want to establish that locus of control. What are some good first steps, some practical things we can actually do? You know, it's not going to solve our entire money issue, but to at least feel like, hey, I've got a handle on it. I can take some steps beyond this.
So there's a couple of things you can do. One of the ones that I really like the best is from a motivational writer named James Clear, who he talks about when you want to make a change in your life, the traditional advice is to set a big goal like, hey, I'm going to lose 25 pounds or, hey, I'm going to pay off all of my debt. Well, there's a problem with that goal setting advice in that the first time you stumble, you feel like, oh, there's no way I'm going to do this. I'm just going to quit. So instead of making a big goal like that, he says, try to figure out what kind of person you want to be. So you might say, I want to be the type of person who sends money every week to my debt. So you could decide to do that. And so every week, no matter how small the amount is, if it's only $10, if it's only $5, but if every week you send money to pay down your debt above and beyond, you know, the minimums that you have to do, then you, with every week, you are making it clear to yourself, like, hey, I keep promises to myself, I am taking care of my debts, and it kind of snowballs into this feeling like I am a person in control.
And you also talk in the book about budgeting, which often people point to as a first step, but I think a lot of people I've heard from them on the show in the past don't really know how to get started. In your book, you talk about a lot of resources out there. What are, for somebody trying to make that first step toward budgeting and maybe finding that level of control, what's a good place to start?
Well, the thing with budgeting is you need to make sure that you budget with your own psychology in mind. A lot of these very detailed budgets, you know, the spreadsheets and all of that, that is not going to work for the vast majority of people. And it's really important that you find a way that works with what you're going to do. Because making the budget's not the hard part, actually. It's adhering to the budget that's the hard part. So there are lots of different things that you can use. There are websites that you can go to that will, like mint.com, for instance, that will aggregate all of your financial choices. And so that will help you just know what's going on. And if you, once someone's tracked the money for you, you can make good decisions. That's a great resource. There's also apps out there that will actually keep track of your money for you and let you know how much you can still spend and still be able to pay all of your bills. So if you're someone who just does not want to pay attention to your money at all, that is a productive way to ignore it. So there's a lot of technology out there right now that makes it a lot easier to find a way to budget without triggering the alarm bells in your head that says, no, I don't want to do this. This is boring.
I want to turn to another source of money and money-related anxiety you talk about in the book, and that's, you know, when we're making a purchase of some sort, medium price, big ticket item, whatever, and the idea that, oh, we've got to research this and we don't want to spend all this money and not make the right decision, even though there might be multiple perfectly adequate decisions. How do we get over that sort of obsession over making sure we don't make that wrong investment decision?
Yes, that's actually Barry Schwartz, who wrote the book The Paradox of Choice. He has dubbed the people who very much agonize over spending decisions like that as maximizers, whereas the people who say, okay, these are my three bare minimums that I need, as long as it clears those three, it's good enough, those are called satisficers. I'm a satisficer and I'm married to a maximizer. and that's actually a very common pairing. And so what you need to do is set artificial limits for yourself as a maximizer, because the problem with maximizing, you know, you think that trying to get the best option is going to be good. The issue is, even if you spend a great deal of time researching, you still second guess yourself after you've made the purchase, and you can make yourself crazy with the research. So set a time limit to the amount of research you can do. I generally say an hour. You're not looking to become the world's foremost authority on, you know, shingles or whatever it is you're researching. You just need to know enough to make a good decision. And then if at the end of the hour you still don't feel comfortable making a good decision, give yourself another hour, but no more. And that allows you to limit the amount of time that you spend obsessing over it. The other rule that I like to give people is the three then five rule. If you're comparing items, start by comparing three items, figure out which is the best of those three, and then compare another five. And if one of the five is better than the best of three, go with that. If the best of three is still best, go with that. You've done your due diligence, and you're not going to be making yourself crazy.
We're talking to Emily Guy Burkin, finance writer and author of End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. She has advice on dealing with the stress and emotions surrounding our money so we can do a better job taking care of our finances.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel your blood pressure go up just thinking about money? Have you taken steps to deal with your finances? Call in and share your experiences and your questions at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Emily Guy Burkin is with us to help take some of the stress out of our finances. Her new book is called End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Does it stress you out to talk about money or even think about it? Have you taken some steps to get a handle on your financial situation? What helped? Did it make you feel better, less stressed once you started tackling it? Do you have questions for our guests on how to get started? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Emily, another big emotional issue you write about dealing with money, resentment, whether of other people, of the system. You say a lot of negative emotion can come out of that, and it doesn't do us much good.
Yes, there's an old saying that resentment is like swallowing poison and expecting the other person to die. And that is very true with money resentment. And while resentment is a pernicious and insidious emotion, no matter why you're feeling it, financial resentment has some more negative aspects to it, including the fact that people will end up trying to spend money because of their financial resentments. And that just kind of entrenches the money stress and the problems. And so it's very important to let go of financial resentment and recognize that there are some things that simply need to be let go, and that that's a gift to you. You are giving yourself a gift by letting go of your resentment rather than feeling like you're condoning whatever it is that you resent.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Jason on the line in Oak Creek. Jason, hi.
Hi. What
do you want to bring up, Jason?
Yeah, my grandfather always... and I was wondering if there was an amount or a percentage that you would give yourself before going on to your bills and whatnot.
Jason, thanks for...
Give yourself confidence for.
Your line is fading in and out, but the gist there was his grandfather, he says, told him to pay himself first, Emily. So he's saying, how much, if that's a good philosophy, how much should we set aside before we start allocating that money to other stuff?
That's a great question, and that's unfortunately I'm going to give the you know expert answer of it depends, but yes, you should pay yourself first. And my rule of thumb is try for 20%. If you can't do 20%, do what you can. If you can do more than 20%, do more than 20%. 20% is a good place to just start. It's a baseline. It's an anchor for you to think of, like, that's how much money that I can set aside, pay myself first, as in, you know, put into emergency fund, put into retirement fund, you know, whatever you need to do, you know, put into a down payment for a house that you're saving up for. So if you are able to set aside 20%, and that includes, you know, whatever you're putting aside for your 401k, if you're already putting, let's say, 10% aside for your 401k, that is part of paying yourself first. And so another 10% would get to your 20%. But don't rest on your laurels. If you can get to 20% easily, what else can you do? The more that you're able to pay yourself first, the better off you'll be, the more likely you'll be able to reach a financially independent situation where you feel like you don't necessarily need to work, which would be a great place to be.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Back to our callers. Stephanie is with us in Madison. Stephanie, hi.
Hello. I really love the way in which you're explaining these techniques, because they're probably techniques that you hear over and over again, but until you can relate to it, how it's said, you don't really start doing them. But my question or comment is that when I was younger and single and paying my own bills, I wasn't very good at it, but then I got into a serious relationship, and I was always wanting to combine the accounts, because even though the bills were the same each month, because, you know, we weren't combining our bills yet, we were able to pay more or pay the bills in a more timely fashion and be more comfortable and on top of it. And so I was just wondering what your thought about combining two incomes, whether it be just serious living together relationships versus marriage.
Stephanie, thanks for the call, and talk about a chance for emotion to get wrapped up in our money, Emily, that relationship issue of how fast and how far to combine assets, accounts, bill paying, you name it. What do you think?
The thing that you need to be really careful of is I really advocate everyone always maintaining at least a little bit of financial independence in marriage, in any long-term relationship. And the reason for that is because financial abuse can be a serious problem. And it can go in either direction. You know, a man can financially abuse a woman can financially abuse a man, you know, parents and children. So maintaining some sort of financial independence is always a good idea. So deciding when to combine finances, I think that should be a step that's on par with, you know, even more than moving in together, like signing a lease together, because that step needs to be taken very, very carefully to make sure that you really know who it is that you're combining your finances with, so you know what it is you're getting into and how you'll be able to take care of yourself in case things don't work out.
Thanks, Stephanie, for the call. Good luck. Emily Guy-Burkin is with us, author of End Financial Stress Now, trying to take some of the psychological anxiety out of our dealings with money. Here's one you get into, Emily, temptation. And this is an issue for people, you know, trying to improve their diets, cut down on bad habits, whatever. And, you know, people who have things well under control, but they have that impulsive spending. How do we structure our lives to avoid that kind of temptation that can throw our budget out of whack?
Well, the thing to remember about temptation is that the best way to avoid temptation is to avoid it. They found that the people who are most likely to stick to their goals are the ones who just structure their lives to avoid temptation. So, you know, think of the dieter who has no cookies or ice cream in the house. So what I say, you need to find a way to do that within finance. So one suggestion I make is take all of your credit card information off of your favorite retail sites so that you actually have to get up and go get your wallet when you have to pay for something, because that gives you enough of a kind of emotional and mental distance between wanting something and paying for it to decide, do I actually want this? Will this actually help me in any way? So creating a little bit of distance between the time that you are looking at something and the time you decide to buy it is very, very important. The other thing to do with temptation is try to remember your motivation. So remembering your motivation can really help you overcome temptations. So there are several ways to do this. Again, you know, the retail sites, if you choose a password that represents your motivation. So for instance, if you have a child who is going to be going to college in the year 2021, you might make your retail site password 2021 OSU, because that's their preferred school. And that will help you remember, do I really have the money to be spending on Amazon right now when I sign in? So trying to keep those things front and center can really help you have that distance you need to decide if the momentary temptation is worth the long-term goal.
Very briefly, as we wrap up, Emily, do people take the emotional side of money seriously enough?
No, I don't think they do. We tend to think that money is simple dollars and cents. Everyone should be able to handle it because everyone can add and subtract. And so people don't realize how emotional money is for them.
We'll leave it there for now. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Emily Guy Burkin, finance writer and author of the book End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. You can share your thoughts. Maybe you've got some advice that you can add to what Emily has been talking about. Have you succeeded, whatever your income and wealth level, have you succeeded in overcoming economic anxiety? Let us know how you did it. Share a tip, share some advice with the other listeners out there. You can do that on the Central Time Facebook page, or of course, as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Again, share your financial stress beating advice on the Central Time Facebook page.